Hello, and welcome back, Noodle Squad. This is Noodle On with Noel, and I am your host, Noel the Noodle. And I want to say welcome. First of all, you might notice something different here in the podcast studio. I got two new chairs, I got a brand new light setup, and I got a brand new LED sign. The problem is this sign, I didn't even think this through, is, I love it, but it's backwards. It's backwards. I didn't think that through. I don't know what I thought. I wasn't thinking it was going to be backwards. That's for sure. Because when the front-facing camera is facing the wall, I guess right now most people are probably just listening to this in the car and probably aren't even looking at it. Although, to be fair, I do want this to be, like I've mentioned before, a video podcast as well. So now I'm in kind of a hot pickle because Noodle On with Noel sign is completely backwards. That's okay, you guys. I guess that's okay. Anyways, moving on from that. Today is a really, I would say it's a hard episode for me. I even have like notes that I wanted to go over because let's call this episode the rock bottom episode. And today's episode isn't easy for me. It's raw, it's vulnerable. And honestly, this is a little scary to share this story. But I do believe in the power of stories. I'm a storyteller. I've made a profession out of storytelling, you know, my life and what I've overcome. And I have made it a mission to share my experiences with addiction. And hopefully, if this even resonates with one person, just one person out there, one person who feels trapped, hopeless, or like they've reached the end, I know this would have been worth it. And today I'm going to take you to the absolute lowest point of my life, the moment when everything felt lost and I was certain there was no coming back. But I'm also going to tell you about the spark, the small, fragile thought that maybe, just maybe, this life wasn't meant for me. Maybe I was meant for something better. So buckle up. This is the rock bottom episode. And before I get to the rest of it, trigger warning. For sure, trigger warning for this episode in particular, because I knew when I made this podcast, I wanted to also share deep, in-depth stories about the turmoil of addiction and what it means to your family. I do want to share that, but I also want it to make it lighthearted, and there will also be very lighthearted episodes, and today is not one of them, so feel free to skip this episode if it's something about heroin and injecting drugs and IV drug use and rehab and mental health disorders, if any of this sounds triggering and something you don't want to listen to, then just skip this episode and we'll see you next week. Because, yeah, I want this to be raw and I want to share this story in particular and get it out there. I've shared it vaguely before, but never in a podcast setting where I can literally share in depth, you know, one of the worst days of my life. I would say, is it the worst day of my life? I don't know. So for anonymity reasons, I don't want to use the people involved in this story. I don't want to use their real names, so we're going to change their names, but these are real people, and I'm not going to share their names. Although, in hindsight, both of these main characters, so to speak, in this story are now dead. They are dead, both of them. And they were good friends of mine. So, but I'm still going to do anonymity. Okay. So let's go back a few years. I am unfortunately 30 years old. No, it's not unfortunate. Well, it's kind of unfortunate. You know, 30 years, almost over the hump, people. So we're going to start with addiction, my addiction, I was, and okay, so remember, this is one day. This is one day, and it's one of the catalysts. It's what they always warn you about in addiction. They say something you with addiction, if you don't get help, it's either death, what was it? Death, jail, or there was another third thing that's really bad. It's a saying, okay? But so, yeah, let's just get into it. The descent. Addiction doesn't start at rock bottom. It starts with something small. For me, it was a way to escape. Escape pain, escape feelings, escape myself, and ultimately self-medicating a underlying disorder called bipolar 2 disorder, which is very, very hard to diagnose when you're in adolescence. It can represent itself as ADHD, and 90% of the time, all the therapists I saw just said I was ADHD or had ADHD, which a lot of people, and anxiety, and a lot of people, a lot of kids who go to pediatric psychiatrists are diagnosed with ADHD because this is a very hard, bipolar 2 at the time, and maybe it's better now, is very hard to diagnose because it presents itself as ADHD very easily, like hypomanic, switching projects. I was never comfortable in my own skin. I was never comfortable. And so, and with a underlying very, very addictive personality, the moment I tried substances like opiates, well, I started out with marijuana. That's how a lot of people start. And then getting into alcohol and then some prescription pills. And the moment I felt these substances in me, it was like something I had never, it's like, oh my God, where has this been my entire life? Where has this been? I was like, I felt like I could breathe. I felt like a new person. Everything just calmed down. My racing thoughts, my everything was like, I like took a breath and it was fantastic. And that's not good because slowly, well, I don't even know if it was slowly. It's went from like 1 to 100 really fast because I was like, well, I need more of that. I can't stand being not on these substances. But addiction, and that's the thing. Addiction is never satisfied. You'll always want more. And before I knew it, I wasn't in control anymore. And that's how it just creeps up on you. You go, wow, I'm going to be sick if I can't get something. And I will say, at the end of it, and this is where this one particular story happened. So this was after, I would say, gosh, 6-7 years of drug abuse in high school. And actually, this story takes place after I had gone to rehab. So I went to rehab for an entire year in the great state of Florida, Delray Beach, Florida, where there's actually been some controversy about these rehabs in Florida of how they just take people's insurance money and no one's getting sober. They just like go there, spend a ton of money, and everyone's still doing drugs because when you put a bunch of addicts in the same area, Delray Beach, Florida, with like, I think it's like they call it the recovery capital of the USA. Maybe they even call it the recovery capital of the world. It's funny when you put a bunch of addicts together who are all like kind of forced into sobriety, whether it was me, I was intervention by my parents, or whether you're court ordered rehab, if you're not there to actually get better, everyone's going to start like, hey, what do we do? How do we get something? It's all addicts. Like that's the entire thing. So that was, never going to work. And it didn't. And when I returned home from Florida, I was worse than when I left for rehab. And this is when I got back, it was finally when I succumbed to what I thought would be, I started using black tar heroin. And I just wanted to say, before we, move on, I wanted to find it. So black tar heroin is not very, I guess it's not very, black tar heroin isn't, I would say, fentanyl is like what it, remember, this is 10 years ago. This is almost a decade ago. So at the time in Tulsa, Oklahoma, black tar was the kind of the go-to, for everyone I communicate. That was what everyone was using, you know, pills like Dilaudid or, what's another one? Dilaudid, that was a big one, but like one pill was worth $30, $30 for like, I remember that. And you needed like six, I needed like six of them to feel anything, to even feel anything. And the problem with black tar heroin was it was like for $30, I could get more and it was so much stronger. I will say it's a horrible, horrible, horrible choice of drug because it doesn't, it's often cut with kind of anything. It's like this black substance and it's often cut because just to fill up the quantity, the space. And it's like this, it's literally what it sounds like, black tar. It smells like vinegar. It's, I remember opening the bags and like being like, or the little like comes in like plastic wrap. Or it did from when I bought it. And it comes in like this plastic wrap. And I remember that I smell vinegar now. And it's like, it's called a trigger. This is what triggers are, you guys. And it just always smelled like vinegar. So the day I hit rock bottom, and I would consider this rock bottom, even though I didn't necessarily stop immediately after, it was very close. Oh, no, I did. I think I did stop immediately after. So the day I hit rock bottom, it wasn't cinematic. There was no big moment. But well, you know what? Let's go from the beginning. We have to come up with names too. We have to come up with names of my people. So the story is starting now of the rock bottom day. Here it is, the start. I'm trying to think of names, which I should have done. Let's go with, there's three main characters in this story. It was people I actually went to middle school with and then kind of kept in touch through high school. And then after I got back to Tulsa, Oklahoma from my first rehab in Florida, I came back and the one person I contacted was a woman named, let's go with Abigail. Okay. Abigail was actually a friend I went to middle school with. I have used before in the past with, and unfortunately I was the first person who showed her how to do, IV drug use. She would have done it anyways, and I still regret it to this day. It's like the person I blame for showing me how to do IV drug use, because intravenous drug use with a needle is pretty much your last step in terms of once you have given up control enough to your addiction that you're willing to do anything like stick random substances from God knows where, who've been touched from who, into your veins, you don't care anymore. You've given up. I didn't care anymore. I just wanted to get high. And nothing about the future, I didn't even think of the future. They used to say this in recovery, they call it blinders. You just have blinders on. And like you just have blinders on and you are so focused on your next fix, your next high. I know it sounds so cliche that nothing else matters. And me and Abigail kind of got into this little, we kind of feed off each other because I had the resources and the money. I had the money and she had the way to get it. And so for the next, like, I would say for the next 2 or 3 months, it was a winter. It was like September to January this happened, this whole little run. We call it a run. When you go on a run, it's where you just are high all the time, fucking everything up, trying to get money. And it was like a 3-month run before this happened. And it was October in Tulsa. So everything's dead. Picture this. It's bleak. It's dead. Everything is gray. There's no sun. Everything's just dead. And it's me and Abigail riding around in the car every day. I would go pick her up and try to find money somehow. And I did bad stuff for money, and I was a shit person. And I would try to find it because I would wake up every morning. Both of us would wake up every morning, and your nose is running. You have like heroin opiate withdrawal feels really, really, everything in your whole world is like, it's like just so, it's like this horrible, horrible depression mixed with like slowly kind of sickness. Like it, you can tell you're getting worse. My nose was running every morning. I had cold sweats. I was like chilly but hot at the same time. And then you start like feeling like you're jumping out of your skin. Like it just is like you're just cannot regulate your nervous system until you get and for me it was at least $100, $150 worth of heroin in one shot, because I was at like $500 a day. So this had gone on for me and Abigail were, you know, doing runs all over Tulsa trying to find this stuff. We went to these really bad spots, and we one day, okay, let's catch up to the worst day. So we've been doing this for months now, and we went over to this person. Let's call him. And this is another person I went to middle school with, and I want to call him Jake. Okay, Jake. So Abigail and Jake, and there's a third person, Abigail, Jake, and let's go with, remember, these are names I need to make up because I'm not going to share their real names. You can't do that. This is their story, not mine. Well, this is their story to tell if they want it known. So we're going to go with Abigail, Jake. Everyone's the same age. We're all like 20. I think we're all 20. And what's the third? There was a third person. Jake, Abigail, and I can't even think of a name. Sam. Let's go with Sam. Okay. Jake, Abigail, and Sam. Okay. So we went over to Jake. This is Abigail's best friend, like literally best friend. Like I thought we were friends, me and Abigail. We were kind of acquaintances-ish. We were kind of using each other also. Like she had the resources to get heroin and I had the money, and we just kind of, but Jake and her were very close. They were like best tight friends. So through their whole adolescence, and I remember this is the first time I had seen Jake since middle school, but we did remember each other pretty vividly. I went, and this was his grandma's house, right? So we went over to his grandma's house, and I think I remember my mom, this is one of the nights my mom was like, where are you? Get home. Because at the time, my parents did know I was using, but like they, I don't know. It's such a mess. Everything was a mess. Everything was horrible. Like they know I was using, but like there wasn't really much they could do to stop me, especially since I had a car. And like, I remember being in the garage of this house, and trying to figure out a way to Photoshop, like put a picture of me and Abigail at the Woodland Hills Mall. Cause I remember saying like, we're at the mall, nothing's going wrong. And we somehow did send a picture. I don't really remember the intricate of that. I just remember saying to my mom, we're at the mall, because in the next 3 hours or so, everything would go to shit. Worst thing I've ever seen. Horrible. And that's where this story really starts. So we were all, I was in this dirty, unfamiliar garage, you know, and there was drugs. There was between the four of us. Yeah. Abigail, Sam, and Jake, and me. So four people. They had a pipe going around. They were smoking meth. And I was like, I think we were sitting in the garage. It was cold, kind of talking, reminiscing. How are you doing? You know, I haven't seen you since middle school. And we're all clearly not doing very well. We're all like not doing well. And so I remember we were waiting for a bag. We were waiting for the heroin. And in the meantime, I was sick. I was frustrated. I was like ready for a hit. Jake, the guy whose house we were at, had suggested meth, literally meth. And meth was huge in Oklahoma. Actually, so was opiates. Big prescription pill problem. But so he suggested taking a hit of meth. And it's not my first time. I have done it before. I had pretty much at that point tried everything. But he said it would help with opiate withdrawal. And I was like, okay, wow. And he was right. It somehow did subtly help with opiate withdrawal. It was the weirdest. Makes me clench my jaw thinking of how meth feels. And so I do remember kind of speeding and waiting. We call it speeding, the effects of it. You're just kind of like, in a weird way, you're so relaxed, but also not. It's a horrible, horrible feeling. So we were waiting on this guy to come bring us the heroin, right? And he finally got there, and we're all high on meth. Everyone took in a hit of it. And this was at the time, we all smoked it, okay? We didn't inject meth. That's a different story. I had done that too. And in the program, by the way, you guys, they call these war stories, and you're not like supposed to share them with each other because everyone tends to just one-up each other. Like in rehab, they told us, no one share war stories. That's what they call them, because like everyone has these stories. If you're an addict, you have these stories of like horrible days, crazy shit that's happened. And they said like, and then basically it turned into like all of us are just one-upping each other. So this is my worst war story, so to speak, but you know, it's been 10 years. So looking back, I do think it's an important thing to share. So, all right. So the heroin comes finally. I was able to get my fix. I was better. We cooked it up in a spoon. You use a cigarette filter. You use like a cigarette filter for the cotton. And I remember, it's just a whole little process. I was like so good at it. It took me 2 minutes to figure it out. And at the time I was having a very, very hard time towards the end, and this is towards the end, of trying to find veins. It was one of the most stressful, horrible feelings on earth, sitting on a bathroom floor and trying to figure out, oh my God, I cannot find a vein. Like all the veins do this weird thing. When you poke them enough, they get scared. They try to protect themselves and they hide in you. And you literally can't find it. And there, at the time, my arms were so scarred up that like I was going to have to start figuring out a different place. So I would use my hands. I found my hands and oh, it hurts. If you miss and you hit something else in your hands and you hit like the bone or something, oh, it's painful. It's very, very painful. Okay, so I did it. Amanda did it. Everyone's kind of high on meth. And then I do vividly remember going into the bedroom of this Jake's grandma's house. And for some reason, Abigail had said, like, she had said, do you want to try some Jake? And I don't think Jake pretty much ever uses heroin. He's a big meth user, but so I remember watching her fix him up a dose and give it to him, but the way I don't know what I was doing or why I don't know why I wasn't paying attention, but she gave him a lot. Like a lot, like they're probably more than I do. Remember, this guy was pretty much a full blown meth user. He really didn't have any tolerance for opiates. And I don't even know what came over anyone. Why was he trying that? But he did try. And it takes like, I don't know. It takes like a minute or two to kind of realize, whoa, that was way too much. And he did this thing, and I was sitting on the floor. I was feeling good the first time all day. It felt normal. And I wasn't even enjoying, like, you don't even get high anymore. You just feel normal. Like, it's not even like a high anymore. It's like the initial rush when you first inject yourself is feeling decent. And then it's like, I don't know, less than 30 minutes later, you're just kind of feeling like, at least I'm not sick anymore, but I still feel horrible. It's just always, and everything's painful. Your skin hurts and like you're always, I was always have a headache. I always had like a random headache. I probably wasn't drinking anything, any water or anything. But he kind of, so Abigail just injected Jake with heroin, a big old dose of heroin. And I know she didn't mean any harm. I remember the third guy, Sam, is here, just kind of there also. And all of a sudden, Jake, like, does this weird, like, kind of backwards fall onto the bed and, like, slumps over. He's kind of like, if you're watching this episode, he's kind of like this. Like, kind of slumped over, making a weird grunting sound. And we're like, that's not the normal reaction. You shouldn't be doing that. That's not how this you're supposed to go. And so, yeah, he was like bent over, slouched over. And I remember Abigail. Sorry, the names are a little hard because I'm trying to remember them. I made these names up. These are not the actual names of these people. But Abigail was like shaking him like, hey, stay with us, Jake, stay with us. Hey, hello. And then all three of us looked at each other and were like, he's looking like he's about to, like, this is an OD. And then the worst thing, he started making the death rattle. Do you guys know what a death rattle is? You can look it up. I have looked it up a lot because I'll never get this sound out of my head. It's when the body is struggling for oxygen. And it's like this sound. It happens in the ICU with like older patients. Well, I actually read a lot about this phenomenon because of this instance. Later, I still read about it. But it's like this sound in their lungs. It's like when the lungs are just doing their best to get oxygen, but the airways or something are closed. I'm not a doctor, so I might be describing this wrong, but I'll try to mimic what it sounds like. It's like, that probably sounded horrible in your ears. I'm sorry. But it's like this weird, it's like literally a rattle. Like it's like a death, it's the death rattle. And it means his lungs cannot get oxygen. It's having a very hard time getting oxygen. So we are like panicking. Yeah, we're all panicking. All three of us are panicking now. And now imagine also being 20. So still like there's no one even, I don't know why the three of us who were still conscious didn't call an ambulance, but we didn't. We didn't call an ambulance, and instead me and Sam, the guy who was still awake, actually put Jake, who's now in about to die, on our shoulders and ran him to the bath, like kind of hobbled over to the bathroom, his arms around me and his other arms around the other guy, and we're splashing water on his face, and he's just kind of slouching over the sink. And then I don't remember all the little detail, like the nuances, but Abigail was like, Noel, go get your car keys, because I was the only one with a car there. And we rushed him to my car and just like threw him in the back. Well, this guy was huge. I remember, what was the name I gave him? Oh, Jake. Jake was huge, like huge. Not in a obese way, but a very tall, muscular guy way. Like 6'5" or something. Like just a tall guy, taller than both me and Sam who were carrying him out. And we threw him in the back of the car, and he laid on top of a man, Abigail. He laid on top of Abigail and Sam. I had to. I was high on meth, just shot a fat syringe of dope, and I was going to try to drive him to the hospital, which was like 10 minutes away. We wanted to go to St. John's, and no one was in their right mind thinking I was driving I was driving, and he literally was dying in the back seat. You could still hear the rattle, and I think they were just screaming at him the whole time. Like, I'll never get out of my head driving to St. John's while this guy was in the back dying, and Abigail screaming, "Jake, Jake, Jake," like the worst sounding, like severe, horrible scream that you could ever, I will never get that out of my head. And he's just dying in the back seat. And I guess I'm responsible for his life now because I was the driver. And it's weird because as soon as like something like this happens, I do remember like I sobered up real quick, I think, at least. Like, I didn't feel anything. I just was, like, in survival mode to get this guy to not die in my car. And we did. We ended up driving. I ended up getting to the hospital. And I think Abigail, we went into the emergency bay where the ambulance pulled. And immediately someone comes out and is like, "You can't park here." And we're like, "We have a patient." Like two or three nurses come out and they're like, "Move, you can't be here. This is for the ambulances." And we're like, we're the ambulance. We have a patient. And he comes out. And anyways, they roll him, they get a wheelchair. We kind of plop him onto the wheelchair, not a gurney, literally a wheelchair. And he's like there's no sound coming out of him. He's blue. There's nothing. And he's slouched over the wheelchair. They take him in and they ask, "What is he taking tonight?" They immediately know it's a substance overdose. And, I actually wasn't part of that conversation. I was just trying to, I think I just moved the car or something, but I remember coming back and sitting right outside the emergency little bay with Sam and Abigail. And it's just the three of us. And, we just sat there for the next like 4 hours. We sat there. And the nurse, a nurse or a staff member kept coming out and kind of updating us. Apparently he did die and they brought him back and, apparently he did die on the table. They brought him back. And I remember like one of the most surreal experiences was driving to this hospital with the guy dying in the back seat, who I've seen as a little kid. Like, you know, we grew up together and he's dying from heroin. And I remember looking out the window and like thinking like, this is not my life. This just is not, this is like not what I'm supposed to be doing. This is where that little glimmer of hope comes by, the turning point, so to speak. I wish I could say I had a huge revelation in that moment. But I didn't. It was a faint thought, like, this is not who I'm supposed to be, and this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. Because I remember driving, and next to St. John's was this beautiful, like, it's called Utica Square. It's like this beautiful little outdoor shopping mall slash shopping restaurants. It's a beautiful little Utica Square in Tulsa. And I remember like coming home from, I remember like, you know, I had just spent a year in Florida and that was kind of my, I think that was like my first time seeing it again. And I was looking at it while we're driving this almost dead man to the hospital. And I remember looking at like a family or something and thinking like, that's normal. Like, life is not supposed to be this hard. Like, this isn't supposed to be this hard. Like, I shouldn't be, I just remember having kind of an out-of-body experience. Like, why am I doing this to myself? It's like something all the time. It's never stopping. It's always something with this. And like, it was like every other day was something. Like, it was just, you're never at peace. Like, it's always it essentially seemed like it was a crisis every day. Like one time, like I remember having to, what's another, like it's just like a crisis every day. Like if I don't somehow get money, I am going to be so sick. And like it's every day. And this went on for months. And this was kind of the climax, so to speak, the climax of the film, you know. And I was like, we're sitting in a hospital at like 9 at night. Actually, I think it was around midnight. And I think this guy just died in my car. He didn't. He lived. That was the last time I saw him, though, was going into the hospital because I ended up having to go home. I think I went home and that was when I got home that night. My mom comes out with a bunch of dirty needles that she found under my bed. She's like, you're going to rehab again. Like, you're done. You're not having a car anymore. And it was like this whole day of accumulation that was it. I can't do this anymore. I was so sick. The reason I was still even doing this was to void off not having to go through a heroin detox because I know how painful it is. And at the time, I considered myself not very good with pain. I think that's a lot of addicts maybe. In hindsight, people who do fight through addiction and get through it are the toughest people you've ever met. They are. But at the time, I remember doing anything possible to not be sick and not go through heroin withdrawal because I know how bad it felt. That was it. Like, that was it. She said the next morning, you're going to detox. We're going to get you into Laureate. Fun fact, that's where Lindsay Lohan went to an eating disorder clinic at Laureate in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I guess that's a fun fact. Never mind. That part might not make it, but she did go there, for her eating disorder. But they do drug rehab too. So that was the last time I saw Jake. That was the last time I saw Jake. And I think, and then, yeah, I never saw really, I guess he stayed the night or was admitted. And then Abigail, that was kind of the last time I saw her that night too, because we all just kind of went separate. I guess she, you know, I don't even know what happened. We had this massive, like, traumatic event happen, and then we just kind of all went our separate ways. I do remember being prescribed Suboxone the next day. I said, I don't know if I can do this just cold turkey. You know, I was shooting up 3 or 4 times a day, and I was thinking, I can't do this cold turkey. And I remember we went to Laureate to try to get me into detox. And this is literally the day after the incident, the rock bottom incident. It's literally the day after. And we went to Laureate. It was me, my mom, and my twin. And I was already going through it. You know, I had to wake up every, and this was like 11 in the afternoon. And I at the time I was having to wake up and do a shot every morning. And so we went to Laureate, and I just remember sitting there like in pain because I was very sick and going through very, very extreme withdrawal. And I did get prescribed Suboxone, which is an opiate receptor blocker. And so it's very, very good to help people who are getting off of heroin or opiates. But it's also very addictive also. But I remember trying to get on it. We got on it. It helped a little bit, not much. You still feel horrible. You still feel sick. But I remember Abigail texting me and was like, hey, are we like, what are we doing now? And I said, I don't have any more resources. I have no, the car's taken away. There's no more money. I can't do this anymore. And she was like, you can't leave me hanging. Like, I need something too. And so I remember actually putting some Suboxone of this to help her. I cared about her. We're still friends. I cared about her deeply a lot. And I know she would hate herself if she did end up killing Jake. But I put some Suboxone in our mailbox, and I guess she somehow found a way to get to my house while I was, I put some, and she got it. She got some, a few of them to help. It's not an end all be all. It doesn't just like help. You also don't want to get hooked on Suboxone either. Cause it's like, supposedly that's even a worse withdrawal than heroin. But that was like the story. That was like the climax. And I found out actually like 5 years later that Jake actually ended up dying anyways. He lived that night, but he died of a shooting actually. And he was on the first 48 in Tulsa, one of his episode. So yeah. He died. I don't really know the whole story behind that. he's dead. And then literally this year, 2024, I found out that my good friend Abigail, who we really were, you know, I cared about her. It never would have worked out as a friendship. Like, all we did was drugs, and really bad drugs, and just used each other to get drugs. But, you know, I saw her as a middle schooler. We were friends in middle school. I saw her with hopes and dreams, and this isn't what she wanted. I'll never forget, she told me one day when we were either waiting for the dope guy to come give us, to come make a deal, or driving to him or something. I just remember how we had a lot of conversations. And she told me one day she wanted to be a flight attendant. And I've always thought of that. I always thought she'd make a great flight attendant. And I'm not going to cry. But it turns out this year she also died I think it was fentanyl. It was fentanyl, because nowadays fentanyl is cut with all this stuff. So it's a good thing I got out when I did. It's really bad that, you know, obviously it's just getting really bad out there. Like, fentanyl apparently is like the easiest thing to cut this stuff with. And so she overdosed. I heard she was doing really good too. She went to rehab in Malibu. And it's also really hard to think, because remember, I stopped this part of my life 10 years ago, like in 2015, maybe 2016, and it's 2025, almost 2025. She has been doing this that much longer. She's still been dealing with this 10 years. She just never got out of it. And I somewhat regret, you know, in all the last 10 years of becoming addicted to triathlons and just basically having a different life and loving sport. And I regret not reaching out more. I do. I regret not reaching out to her, because I thought about her all the time, because she was like kind of my ride or die during addiction. And I still cared about her, and I know she was just as sick as me. And once again, I was the reason she even started using. I taught her how to use intravenous drugs, and how to tie off, and how to find a vein properly, and how to cook it, and like someone did with me too. So, because people don't just like, you don't just wake up and like try intravenous heroin. Like, someone has to kind of introduce you to it. You kind of have to be like, you kind of have to want to like, you kind of have to not care enough about yourself to even want to do it. The scariest part of addiction is addiction steals your ability to care. You know, it steals your ability to care about anything. And I didn't. I didn't care about anything. And, well, you know, that's not true. I do think I cared. I just think I didn't have the ability to – I don't think I wanted to be sick enough. I didn't want to be sick enough that I would do anything to keep getting high, because I knew how bad being sick feels. And that's like really a big, big, big part of opiate addiction, is how bad it makes you feel when you can't get it. You just feel hopeless. You feel like you're going to jump. They call it like skin crawling feeling. And it's so accurate, because you feel like you're going to jump out of your skin and you get sick. And I just think I'd look back and think, I wish I had talked to her more, or at least checked in. We checked in here and there. I actually talked to her I have a voice message from her, and I almost want to play it, but I guess that's against, I shouldn't play it. But I have a voice message from her. I kept it. And the last time we had spoke before the time I found out she died from someone else, I found out from someone else, you know, the Facebook rounds, and it was really sad, because she was meant for something better. I feel like I was meant for something better than dying from addiction. And I think she was too, but she just couldn't get out of it. And for whatever reason, I had the resources to get out of it. She didn't, you know, she didn't have any help. She made it as long as I think she could. She even got endocarditis at one point, which is a heart infection from using, and which is a big, big deal from using intravenous drugs. It can infect the heart lining or something from shooting up. And it's tragic. I'd like to think that they're both together now because they loved each other. They were not in a platonic way. They were not boyfriend and girlfriend, but they both, Jake and Abigail, you know, they survived as long as this addiction, they survived as long as they could. And they're basically textbook examples of what happens when you just keep going. And it was really, 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 really sad. I actually remember when I did find out about Abigail's death this summer, I was actually in the middle of a bike ride. I was in the middle of a 5-hour bike ride. And I spent the next 2 hours going home, just sobbing and crying on the bike, like crying while in TT position. It was horrible. And I just thought about how, had she found the same type of help I did or something, or some type of resources, I don't know, she would still be here. And I'm not going to harp on that, especially not on this podcast, but that was kind of a big, in the program, they call it rock bottom. And I would say that whole little instance of watching him lose his ability to breathe and turn blue and then die in my car. And then at the same exact night, watching my mom scream at me, holding a bunch of needles that she found, saying, "You're going," like all of that. Yeah, that was rock bottom. And I would say there's multiple days I could attribute as rock bottom. Recovery isn't a straight line. It's messy, it's painful, and it's full of setbacks. But every step forward counts, even if it's just one day clean, 1 hour, 1 minute. That's what they say. I guess you really do have to take it one day at a time. And there are people who stood by me when I didn't deserve it. People who saw flickers of light in me when all I saw was darkness. If you're listening to this right now and you feel alone, please know you are not alone. Someone sees you. Someone loves you. And if no one comes to mind, let me be that person today. Sometimes that's all it takes, is one person to say, "I am here for you." Because I feel like Jake or Abigail didn't have that in their lives, you know? That's all it takes. And who knows what, if just one person said something, they would both be here. So now here I am sitting in front of this microphone sharing this story with you. I started with the smallest steps, asking for help, showing up to meetings, being honest with myself about how bad it had gotten. And I won't lie to you, it was very hard, but slowly things started to shift. The fog started to lift. And I started to see glimpses of a life that felt possible. That is a kind of cheesy way of saying, once you are kind of out of it for so long, and like it had been a few months of just nothing, you know, there is a fog that lifts and like all your emotions coming back. One of the things that happened in rehab, and I actually spent, I don't know about anymore, but at the time, what a fun record to have. I wish I had a different record, but the record was like 4 months and 3 days. I had like the longest time spent in this specific rehab, Genesis House in Delray Beach, Florida. I have like the record of the longest stay, but that was only because I got in at September and ended up staying past New Year's in this little rehab. And a couple people I met there are dead now also. If you're listening to this and you're struggling, if you're at your rock bottom, I want you to hear me loud and clear. It's not too late. You are not too far gone. You are not beyond saving. There are people who want to help you, resources, support groups, friends, strangers who care, because there are strangers who care. I have met the most caring strangers, but the first step has to come from you. It doesn't have to be big. It can be the smallest whisper, just like mine was. And I want to just touch on that just a tiny bit because, you know, out of all the times I tried to get sober, well, it wasn't too many times. It wasn't. I mean, this went on for like 8 years, but I wanted it. When it worked, I wanted it. I had seen enough. I was done. No amount of someone forcing me into a rehab or court ordered or something, no amount of that was going to work. It is not going to work unless I wanted it to. I wanted it to work. I wanted to be done with this shit. I was like, this is not how I'm supposed to be living. You are worthy of love, of happiness, of a life that feels good to wake up to. Please, please believe that. Waking up with active addiction, I hated it. I hated waking up. I couldn't stand it. You know, those few months in that winter, I guess the winter of 2015 before this happened, and when we were in active heroin addiction, I hated waking up. You know, I would look at my clock at like 3 a.m. and go like, oh, it's only like a few more hours before I'm starting to get really sick. I hated going to bed too because I knew I'd have to wake up. Like the feeling of like just so hopelessness. Like I just felt so alone. Like knowing like I wasn't alone. I had family that cared about me, but I was just so alone and suffering. And I remember like going to bed at night and thinking like I don't want to go to bed because I know I'm going to have to get up and barely sleep through the night or sleep well. And then know the minute I get up, I have to go get in that stupid car and be stressed and try to find a way to get money, to get high all day long and then do it again. And it's like this horrible cycle. And like, you never feel good. Maybe for like 10 seconds when you first inject yourself, it's like this buzzing. It feels really good. It gets like this warm feeling in your chest and stuff. And then it just goes away and you're just like kind of normal. And you're just like, I just spent $100 on that just to feel normal. And then we have to go, why we feel normal, to go find other money to go again. And it's like this horrible, horrible cycle. This was a heavy episode, and I definitely hope if this even helps one person of how bad my situation got and how I still found a way out, you know. And in this story, I shared about my friends who didn't make it out, who didn't have a, they tried. I want to say they tried. They did their best. And there are people like that every day now who are dying of fentanyl. And I guess I want to say, I hope this helps someone. If this helps just one person, then this was a success. Thank you for listening to this episode of Noodle On with Noel. Sharing this wasn't easy, but if my story even helps one person out there, then it's worth every second. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please check the show notes for resources and hotlines you can call. You are not alone. And if this episode spoke to you, if it made you feel something, please reach out. I'd love to hear from you. Take care of yourselves, be kind to yourselves, and remember, even at rock bottom, there's a way up. This was an episode of Noodle On with Noel, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you do like these episodes, please leave a review, follow us on Spotify and all the podcasting platforms. I am your host, Noel Mulkey, and this has been another episode of Noodle On with Noel. Thank you.